This episode first aired on our new channel, Leaders in Tech and E-commerce Podcast. It covers supply chain tech in depth. We do hope you enjoy it and feel free to follow our other podcast as well for the latest episodes.
It's a pleasure to have with us today Michael Farlekas from E2Open. Michael joined the company in 2015 as the CEO. In this role, he is responsible for leading the company's overall operations with direct oversight of sales, marketing, professional services, research and development, and strategy. Michael brings to E2Open more than 20 years of sales, marketing, and leadership experience in supply chain management and enterprise software. Now, a few words about E2Open. E2Open is bringing together data from customers, distribution channels, suppliers, contract manufacturers, and logistics partners. Their collaborative and agile supply chain platform enables companies to use data in real time with artificial intelligence and machine learning to drive smarter decisions. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the podcast, and it's great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Andre. Good to be with you as well.
Excellent. So let's start with the introduction. I'm curious about your career so far. What are some main milestones of it? And what is the most exciting part of being the CEO of E2Open?
Yeah, let me start with the last part. You know, the most exciting part about leading E2Open is our ability to create, our ability to have an idea and to see that idea come to life through, you know, 2,400 fantastic team members. To me, that's the most exciting thing. And we have a kind of a strong bias in our company of everybody having the ability to make an impact every day. And that's pretty important to our success and pretty important to our overall culture. As far as my background, I started my logistics career working for the CSX Transportation Railroad Company. And I had operational and then commercial roles there. And I kind of moved over into the software kind of area right after the dot-com bubble burst in 2001, and wanted to take my career into more of a technology, more innovation area, where I became a individual contributor for selling of warehouse management, transportation management software, and did that for a number of years, and then it moved into the general manager role, you know, about 2012, and then came on to E2Open as CEO in 2015. So I have a broad background in the commercial area, and then obviously in supply chain logistics for my career, starting with the CSX, and now, you know, heavily involved with technology and software for the past, you know, 20 years or so.
20 years is a lot of experience, a lot of war stories, I'm sure. I wanted to ask you directly about E2Open, and I'm sure you have to explain this to new customers as well, but how is E2Open different compared to the other players on the market?
Yeah, E2Open is very different in two main respects. The first is that we started our life as a network-based company, as a cloud-based company. The company started in 2001 era, and it was started by a consortium of high-tech manufacturers that came together to solve a particular problem, which is how do you orchestrate a very complex multi-tier manufacturing environment across multiple tiers and hundreds, if not thousands, of outsourced, you know, trading partners to help companies manufacture things like, you know, cell phone and servers and computers and laptops and things. And that problem is how the company was formed. It was formed in the cloud. It was formed as a network-based company because you have to connect all of these enterprises together to create one application. It could not be done in an on-premise footprint back even then. So we've always been in the cloud. But what makes us most unique is that we connect multiple applications together to create one process across an end-to-end supply chain. And we have data and applications that we bring together natively in one platform. So today, we've taken that concept of multi-enterprise orchestration for manufacturing and high-tech environment to full end-to-end, starting with demand, going all the way back to supply, for all industries. And we now have, you know, 240 or so thousand connected trading partners on our network. And we have a very connected ecosystem. So we're solving a problem of connectivity. And that connectivity is two dimensions. The first dimension is outside in, and the second dimension is end to end. And that's distinguished from the state of today's supply chain software market, which is mostly around point solutions, WMS, a TMS, a planning system, and where companies, big manufacturers and big brand owners have to figure out how to connect all those disparate applications themselves. And it's also disconnected from outside in, because most large global manufacturers, you know, actually outsource most of their process. They don't supply their own, you know, goods in terms of ingredients or components. They don't convert them to finished product all the time, because they use a lot of outsourced manufacturing for that. They don't ship it themselves. They don't store it themselves, and they don't sell it themselves. They use retailers and resellers to do that work for them. So the manufacturer over the past 30 or 40 years has transformed themselves into brand owners and orchestrators of complex processes. And that's where we help customers most. That's what makes us most different. And it also is where we add the most value to our, you know, very large global enterprises.
That's interesting. And that fact of manufacturers being brand owners is an interesting perspective. You posted on LinkedIn recently, and it caught my eye. Which is more important, the chicken or the egg? And the answer is both are essential. And then you talked about data and application and how it connects to it. I know a recent product from E2Open is Visibility for All. I imagine there is a connection between the chicken and the egg and the data and application and visibility for all. I would like to hear you talk more about this.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big, you know, every can't go on any news outlet of any type and not hear the words AI or machine learning. And those tools are extremely important and extremely valuable. They consume vast amounts of data to produce really valuable answers. But the point is, without the data, those applications don't really do much. They're useless, in fact. They don't do anything. They're just an algorithm, just an equation. An important equation, one that's very difficult to understand, difficult to make, not simple, but without the data, they can't do much. And then likewise, if you were to provide, you know, every single data point in the world in a spreadsheet by itself as raw data, that's not very useful either. And what is most valuable is taking data at scale and putting them into algorithms. And in our world, algorithms mean applications, because the applications are an assembly of algorithms to make the business decision. So when we say the most essential ingredient is them together, we really mean that, which is why we have a network-based business and we have the world's best algorithms and applications on top of that. So that's kind of the whole concept of our business. And Visibility for All is really just an extension of that, which is there's a lot of type. And I've seen these hypes before around visibility and logistics visibility and, you know, where's my truck? And that's great. If people don't know where their truck is, they have a great need for that truck to see where that truck is or that container on an ocean ship, et cetera. But that doesn't actually translate to business value until you apply it and give that information to an application, which can then make a decision. Like the decision might be, what's the impact of that container being early, later on time? You know, I shipped it 7 weeks ago with an assumption of I needed it 7 weeks from today, and now things have changed in 7 weeks. So just because my original early, you know, estimated time of arrival was preset doesn't mean it's the same need for the business 7 weeks from now or 7 weeks before. So in that sense, applications help businesses make sense of that data. So our strategy and our purpose is really to say, having that information in terms of logistics visibility is vitally important. It's critically important, but it's only a first step. And we don't think it's tremendously value adding to our clients. So we decided to offer that logistics visibility for any mode, for all geographies, unlimited volume, and include that in any subscription software application our clients have. That's been, you know, we launched it yesterday morning and we've signed up dozens and dozens of customers already. So a lot of demand for it and really super excited by it. But it's really under the same assumption, which is that data is really important, but we can do more with it. And we would rather be in the value add business rather than a data providing business. And we think that's more sustainable for our business and more sustainably valuable for our clients. Does that make sense, Andre?
Yeah. That's interesting. And I wanted to touch upon the importance of having the right data and not hyping or not expecting wonders from AI and machine learning, especially in a situation where a crisis occurs. And we have been going through a crisis on different levels. And of course, supply chains manufacturers have been put on the spot in different situations. So what I wanted to ask, Michael, when something like this happened that hasn't happened in the recent history, what is the relevant data that we can use? How can we make sense of it using a smart solution, a smart application? What do you see?
You can think of data in terms of three dimensions. The first dimension is completeness. How complete is the data set? If, you know, it's obvious to say if you have 1% of all the data necessary to make the decision won't be as valuable as if you had 99%. So completeness is kind of one, you know, really key criteria or attribute of a data set. The second is accuracy. Like, how accurate is that data? Is it really accurate? If I really kind of understood the data coming in to a data set and I went back and actually verified it empirically, how accurate is that data? The third is timeliness, meaning how quickly from the event do I perceive and understand that data? Is that measured in, you know, seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months? So the reason we believe in a network business, the reason we believe in connecting to the source of the data is that it helps us in all three dimensions, especially in the timeliness side of it. So if you think about the problem, I have 100 trading partners or 1,000 trading partners. And if I need to get that data in, I need to get it as soon as possible, because the sooner I get it, the sooner I can react to it, the sooner I can make a decision against it, which is why having applications and data together in one, you know, natively in one platform drives a tremendous amount of value to our large scale customers. And this shows up, I think, mostly in this crisis in terms of demand sensing. So we have the best predictor of future demand in the world. It's been proven over a decade now. Most, if not all, a huge percentage of the, you know, CPG and food and beverage companies use demand sensing every day to predict what they're going to sell at an item store location. That application receives downstream data in terms of point of sale, weather data, sentiment data, inventory data at the retailer or channel distributor. And it brings all that data in and makes a really accurate forecasting decision over the next, you know, 6, 12, 8, you know, weeks and months, whatever time horizon you like. So we've seen dramatic changes in demand profiles against our customers, and our customers, a lot of feedback that as the crisis started to hit and as consumer behaviors changed dramatically overnight, that application was tremendously valuable for them to be able to see what's going to happen 6 weeks, 8 weeks from now, which then allows them to figure out, okay, how do I meet the supply and manufacturing requirements for that now changed demand. In some cases, it's, you know, very, you know, a drop off of demand. In some cases, it's an explosion of demand. And depending on the product everybody was in the business of, they would have a very different perception of reality. So some of our clients, you know, the volumes dropped dramatically. Some, they went off the charts. Some, their distribution methods changed dramatically. We have some retail apparel companies where their volumes dropped a bit, but really how they brought products to market changed dramatically. And we're able to perceive that very quickly today for what's going to happen 6 to 8 weeks from now. And we always anchor ourselves around that demand signal and around the forward projection, because if you can make that super accurate, then everything behind it becomes really, really valuable. So our whole value proposition and kind of our process starts with understanding the demand signal from the source, using the best algorithms in the world to take that data and make a very accurate forward prediction of what's going to be sold in the future, and then working backwards from there, and then understanding and managing the manufacturing, distribution, and logistics process to bring those goods to market.
Got it. Can we go into a specific example, Michael? That would be very interesting for our listeners if we can bring up. We don't need to name any names, of course, but if you can give us an example of a client who has seen excellent results in improving their operations using the solution, and if there are some numbers that you could share, that would be great as well.
No, it's really across the board. So our platform is end-to-end and truly end-to-end, meaning we start with the inventory and what's sold today at a retailer, a channel, or distributor. Uh-huh. That's the beginning of our platform. And the end of the platform is the raw material coming into a manufacturing process at the nth tier. That could be silicon on the high-tech world. That could be, you know, wheat or, you know, corn syrup on the process side, or wood pulp for, you know, Kleenex. as an example. So that's end-to-end. So if you think about the impact we have on our clients, it's dramatic, and it's most dramatic when they have as many of our applications and network tied together in one process. So for instance, in the kind of manufacturing side, you know, we have clients that, you know, have decided to really use planning to be able to understand how they could shift from, you know, air transportation to, you know, ocean transportation. Ocean transportation is 7 times less expensive than air transportation. We're talking about, you know, air freight. And there are a lot of companies out there that rely on air freight every single day. We have one customer that more than justified the entire project just by changing the percentage that they went from air to ocean as a permanent shift. This is not related to COVID. This is just their own planning process. Dramatically, dramatically valuable to them, you know, in the terms of, you know, dollars per unit. And the dollars per unit in many of our cases is a very large increase in terms of gross margin of their product. So by understanding lead times and understanding, you know, planning and understanding visibility better, now they can think about, I don't need to ship as many things on that 747, you know, from Korea to the United States. I can put more on a boat. That's one area. And on the other end is we see customers all the time tell us that by understanding their forecasts much better at the retail and distributor level, they can, you know, make sure they have product at the right amount and closest to where it's needed in the right time. And that reduces inventory overall, and that reduces expedites and moving product around. Because most of the large companies struggle with getting the right product in the right geography, and they spend all sorts of money varying a plan that they came up with because it didn't turn to be true, mostly because the demand was off. So those are two really specific examples where you have, you know, dozens and dozens of customers saying to us, it's just transformational in terms of the value they get from using our applications. And, you know, that's the business we want to be in. We want to be, for our customers, the software company, not supply chain software company, but software company that provide the most value for them.
I understand. And you mentioned an interesting trend here, the manufacturer who decided to go from air to ocean, and then, of course, ocean has a better price point. Are there other trends that you see overall? Because you work with global clients in different geographies, different industries. Has this crisis triggered some trends that are worth explaining?
I don't think the crisis has triggered anything. I think the crisis has accelerated some things, especially in the area of resiliency. I think companies have been thinking about supply chain resiliency, which really means redundancy and disparity of supply sources and disparity of markets they serve. And they've been doing that for a while. I think this is going to accelerate, and it has accelerated that concept of, I have to make sure I have a resilient supply chain, meaning if one geography, for whatever reason, can't provide the things I need in terms of either a market or in terms of supply, then how do I adjust to make sure I meet my business outcomes and meet my projections and my commitments in terms of, you know, my financial performance? So I see it accelerating, you know, trends that already are in place. And then one area in particular we see is that the continued march towards using an asset-light approach to their operations. And that means, you know, using specialists and outsourcing more in all functions over time. And that trend started in the 90s and 2000s with component manufacturers, and now is really, really spreading into the process manufacturers in a way that they're saying, hey, I don't necessarily want to build another plant to make, you know, cereal or something, or, you know, some type of, you know, processed product. I'd rather just outsource that. And I'd rather just continue to outsource more and more things. That makes the supply chain more resilient because I'm not fixed in a location anymore, but also makes the supply chain more complex because you can imagine I have to now think about my interaction with a third party. How do I get product there? That's going to be dispersed. So I see that all those trends accelerating because they provide a better return on invested capital. It makes you more resilient. And ultimately, it allows you to be more efficient in terms of, you know, output per input.
Got it. Michael, I wanted to ask you on the client side, expectation management in general. And I imagine there are different type of clients, different type of needs. I hear this a lot. There are a lot of maybe new clients or old clients who come to you and say, we need help now. It's an emergency. We needed this yesterday, so to speak. What are some important challenges when managing these expectations? How do you interact with this type of requests?
Yeah, this has been, I've noticed this for as long as I've been in the technology business, which is technology in and of itself is never the only answer. And it's usually related to the technology and the process and the alignment internally of these really large companies. Those three things have to be together to create dramatic change. And it's often the case, and we really work hard with our customers to really not address the symptom of the problem, but kind of really understand the cause of the problem in an organization. So, you know, the symptom might be my out of stock and in full ratios are not right. So I want to address that problem. And if you kind of really take a step back, it's not necessarily that you don't have a great logistics function, you know, getting product to a customer. That could be a part of the problem. Generally, the problem is related to something much more fundamental. And that's where we really try to help customers. And we try to really think about the problem in terms of staged, methodical value and operational improvement and not a big bang. So the customers, our customers that, you know, derive the most value from our applications are ones that take a view that says, I'm going to try to solve a fundamental problem first, over a 6 to 8 month time horizon. And then when I get to that point, then I'm going to take the next step and then the next step and the next step and along a kind of a high level vision and a roadmap that might be years long. And we kind of literally build our business around this idea of business release one, business release two. And we have clients that have, you know, now business release 40, and it's a constant improvement and adding to the value they get by adding more and more sophistication and complexity over time. But you can't add sophistication and complexity on top of something that is not fundamentally sound. So people that get the most value from application start with the end in mind, but begin in the beginning and don't try to solve all their problems in, you know, 6 to 9 months or a 1 year project. And that is the most value added. So we have, you know, our best relationships are with clients where we're looking at, you know, not just the project now and to go live in the next 4 months, but the project after that and the project after that and along a continuum. And those companies are dramatically better than their competitors because they take a realistic view of, you know, their operation and how to improve their operation over time and don't swing for the fences. This is a singles and doubles game. And if you're solid about your fundamentals, you will go further faster than if you try to solve every problem in one fell swoop.
Got it. Like you said, technology for the sake of technology doesn't work. There is no silver bullet. And I think you touched upon the idea of the importance of change management and making sure that the minds and hearts of people are in the right place and they understand the cause and then move forward. What I would like to find out more, because you've interacted with so many clients, from change management perspective, what do you think are the most important priorities for an organization to see that change? Is it the leadership has to be clear and then go top, bottom? Is it bottom up? Or there is case to case. Is there any principles you could share?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about the world in terms of supply chain software and supply chain change management. I think it's most interesting for this topic and our discussion is that if you take a step back, some things are pretty clear. One of them is most of the work that companies do happens outside their four walls and outside their ecosystem. That's obvious, but you don't think of it that way. You just think of it as the world. But if you step back and really ground yourself on that principle, you got to think about a solution to that problem differently. So that's one principle. The second principle is that organizations are organized functionally, but the supply chain problem is extraordinarily horizontal. Let me give you just the classic concept here. And then it goes into every aspect of how companies are organized. So if you think about, you know, supply is obviously connected to demand and you have one group, you know, call it marketing or sales responsible for demand and another group responsible for supply, those groups are in different functional areas of a company. Although the problem is extraordinarily horizontal. And, you know, one of the things that we see with our most effective, you know, users of technology, our clients, are ones that have very good alignment across the different functions, so that those concepts and you're solving an end-to-end problem. And even if you just understand the end-to-end problem, and you was that eliminates or provides an opportunity to not be, you know, optimized suboptimally. So I can optimize my demand side, but it has to be done in the context of my supply side. So I think the companies that operate best are the ones that look at the problem holistically, have alignment at the top, and then sequence different initiatives and projects and change across a continuum and order of operations that makes the most sense. You know, yeah. Your listeners may not appreciate the name of Lee Iacocca, but you know, there's obviously realms of stories about Lee Iacocca, and his claim to fame was, you know, he decided and looked at the operations of the Mustangs and decided that and figured out that if he just simply made that Mustang literally 6 inches shorter, they could put one more car on a rail car, and that would dramatically change the economics. Those are the things that companies think about end to end. And the more they do that, the more of an efficient operation they'll be.
That's interesting. Got it. If we were to look ahead and look to the future for E2 as well, what is next for E2 Open? What are some of the expansion plans, or what excites you as the next milestones?
Yeah, I believe E2 Open has an opportunity to be a very big and substantial business, mostly because of your first question, which is what makes us different. What makes us different is that we have a network, and that network can be reused over and over again. And that just changes the value drivers that we can provide our customers, you know, in now and in the future. So, you know, our future is going to be built around this idea of connecting all of these network supply chain functions into one operating platform for a client, and to be able to do that in the most efficient way, and to be able to drive the most value for our customers. So that concept is extraordinarily unique. If the software world for supply chain is broken into two broad categories today, you have connectivity companies who go to market and say, I will help connect, you know, trading partners together and provide data to large organizations. That's one classification. The second classification is, you know, best of breed software providers that provide one specific area of functionality, and their claim to fame is, we do the best at planning, we do the best at TMS, et cetera, et cetera. And why we're different is that we have an ecosystem, we have an end-to-end connected platform, so every function in the supply chain can be affected by our platform. And we handle the data connectivity as natively as part of our subscription price. So we don't charge our customers for connectivity that comes with a subscription. And that allows companies to free up, and instead of spending their time connecting disparate applications and managing disparate applications and managing disparate data, they can focus on the important things, which is, how do I get the most value out of this new technology and new tool? And that makes us very different and unique, and there's really not any other company like us that has that capability at scale. So that's why I think this business can be a very, very big business. And we're super excited about the future. We've grown the business 5x since 2015, and we think we can grow at even a faster pace going forward.
And geographically, would you say, I mean, I imagine North America, Europe are very strong for you. Do you have some targets when it comes to geographies as well?
Yeah, we're very strong in, as you said, Western Europe and in North America, so our primary business. But we're doing more work in LATAM and more work in Asia in particular. I think that's kind of our next area, and the next one there would be the Middle East. So I think, you know, we're already pursuing all of those strategies today, building around our core growth base. So we're very clear about who our customer is. Our customer is the manufacturer, the brand owner, that is, you know, bringing product to market. Our network is comprised of hundreds of thousands of trading partners that are extraordinarily global. And that's because all of our customers use that network around the world because their operations are very global. So our operations are extraordinarily global. The markets we serve right now are primarily North America and Western Europe. And we're moving, you know, pretty aggressively into those other geographies, as I mentioned.
Go ahead. Michael, I would like to shift a bit the discussion and go towards more of a leadership segment, leadership and teams. And I wanted to talk a bit about culture and how important culture is. So the question is, how do you define a good company culture, and what are you most proud of when it comes to E2Open culture?
Yeah, how do you define a culture for a company is really a kind of interesting thing. I think it starts with, it has to be authentic. It has to be real. You can't manufacture culture. You know, you can't just sit there and say, oh, I want this culture to be X and then somehow derive it. It has to happen collectively. It has to happen, you know, across the board. And that's the role of, you know, really the leadership team and kind of being aligned on the kind of company, you know, you want to be. You know, and for us, that meant when we started in 2015, after we took the company private, one of the very first things we did was we created, you know, what we call operating principles. And those operating principles were important to us in terms of not what we did as a company, but how we went about our business day to day. And that framework of operating principles allowed us to have, you know, one core set of beliefs that we can, you know, agree to operate to and disseminate across a large and growing company. It grounds us to a set of guidelines that are really important. These guidelines are things like, you know, operate with, you know, trust and integrity, those types of things that are extremely important to us as a company. And that's what drove kind of our culture. We have a very aspirational culture. We do, you know, we take on challenges that most companies would not take on. We operate at a speed, we think, and change our company at a speed most companies would not take on. And we're very tolerant of being able to do that, primarily because we've built the business and grounded it in this idea of, you know, working together at a high level. So I think in terms of culture, it starts with leadership. It starts with how do you want to operate your business? And then the most important thing is alignment, where that everybody can think along those lines and kind of buy into the culture you're trying to create.
Hmm. And when you interview, because as a CEO, you have to take part of many interviews, and especially when you hire for your own team.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, what's your philosophy in interviews? What do you look for in an individual, especially the ones that are very close to you? How do you go about that?
Yeah, there's really two broad criteria that we kind of think about. The first is, you know, is this person a good person? Will they put the other person first? Will they make sure that in every interaction, they put themselves in the shoes of the other person and, you know, think about driving value to that interaction and having a tremendous amount of empathy and looking at the world from the other person's perspective? That's really the first test. And if you don't pass that test, there really is no second test. Second part of the equation is competency. You know, do they have competency to do the role that they are being asked to do in terms of a new hire? And what is their potentiality or headroom? You know, is this person coming in, and I follow baseball and, you know, think about baseball, and, you know, is this person coming in at a you know, 250 hitter for this role, but really has the potential to, over the next, you know, 2 or 3 years, become a 300 hitter? You know, those are people we really seek out, are those people that have show a lot of potential, show a lot of empathy, and have the drive and want to kind of do more things. I mean, that's really kind of the trifecta for us in terms of what we really, really strive for. We, you know, in terms of experience is important, but I wouldn't say that's our number one criteria. I would rather say our number one criteria is this person a quality individual? And if they are, what are we asking this person, he or she, to do now? And what role could they likely have for us in the future across all our dimensions? So we promote a tremendously large number of people, you know, every year. It's in the category of 20% of our workforce is promoted every single year. And that's been hugely successful for us because it allows us to kind of drive the culture you mentioned throughout the organization over time. And we're very judicious about bringing people in from the outside. And we'll do that. We obviously do that. But we try to think about that in terms of senior levels at a very kind of methodically paced way. Because we're really being careful to drive us a culture that's replicatable and repeatable over time.
Got it. And a lot of companies have been hit by this crisis in different ways. Some have taken a step back and decided Maybe they are going to cut a few, you know, it depends, because some of them identify efficiencies or lack of efficiency and they decide to maybe let some people go, others even hire. I wonder for you as E2Open, how has hiring been affected in the last few months, and what's your perception about that?
You know, we have a plan. We didn't really deviate from that plan tremendously much. I can tell you that this has presented opportunities in many cases to top grade our talent when we're thinking about that. But we don't have a change. I mean, we're in a very efficient business. We have a good translation of, you know, gross margin to profitability for a business of our size. We think it's appropriate to balance the needs of our clients and the needs of our people and needs of our owners. So we think we're in a good spot there. So we don't have and we tend to try to operate in that zone. So we never really try to get too ahead of ourselves in terms of, you know, investing in, you know, tremendously in growth at the degradation of investments into our company, more profitability. So we try to manage that. And that hasn't changed. We still try to manage within that really kind of sweet spot of, you know, being able to, you know, take care of our constituents, our being our customers, our people, and our owners in a balanced way. We haven't changed any of that. What I think what's changed is, you know, there's a lot more talent available now, and people are coming to us. And I think that's a function of obviously experience of COVID, where, you know, other companies are having to make changes. So that presents opportunities, but more, it's also a function of our scale and size and us growing and being successful in the marketplace, where people are coming to us now, where 4 years ago, that wasn't so much the case because we were a much smaller company. We're a $75 million company then. We're, you know, approaching $380 million company now in 4.5 years. So that's allowed us to attract talent in a way that makes it easier for us in a way.
Like you said, I think keeping to the plan is very important, be it bad weather or good weather. I wanted to ask more of a personal type of a question and then get your take on it. How do you know you are successful as a CEO, Michael? What are some of those, or no, what's the North Star for you in this case?
Yeah, you know, I had this great friend of mine before I became a CEO. Always said the biggest worry of being a CEO is that, you know, you walk around the earth thinking the world is like sunny and breezy and beautiful. And meanwhile, the reality is quite different. And that's because, you know, just because of the dynamics of a CEO's position, you know, people tend to kind of just want to bring good news. So I think for me, and what I really try hard to understand, is the reality of the world for our people, for their lives and what they're trying to manage, not just professionally, but personally, and trying to understand the reality for our clients in terms of, you know, our delivery of the promises we make and make every single day in terms of, you know, reliability of our applications, in terms of reliability of our projects, in terms of how we interact with them. So I think that's kind of the thing that I really focus on the most, which is having a clear understanding of, you know, what the reality on the ground is. And we have various techniques I use and our leadership team uses to do that. Like we track our business and forecast our business every single week. We have a huge set of operating metrics that come out every single Tuesday. Those operating metrics are down to the individual level in terms of, you know, utilization and performance that we can kind of trend and track over time, you know, starting with, you know, individuals all the way up through different business units and sectors. That information is shared to our board. At the same time I see it, it's shared to my executive team. And it's shared to our field leadership group, which is about 100, you know, field leaders that we've identified as really the most important field or unit leaders across the organization. And by kind of everybody seeing the same data at the same time helps everybody get a really good perspective on where we actually are. Now, it's not perfect, and we have to do a lot of conversations to make sure that, you know, what I perceive is as close to reality as possible. So the answer to your question is, how do I know I'm doing a good job? I don't, other than trying to run the business and meet our, you know, thoughtful plan every year. You know, we put together an aggressive plan, and then we track that plan every week, every month, and you know, and hopefully we're successful in that endeavor. But, you know, there's a healthy amount of paranoia when you're a CEO saying, am I sure that, you know, we're delivering on the promises that, you know, we make as an organization, And am I understanding the world from, you know, the reality of our people, team members, and also our customers, and trying to make sure we really understand that as we go forward. I think that's kind of what I'm most focused on is what I'm perceiving really what's happening on the ground. And if not, how do we, you know, make sure we have alignment so we can do something about it?
That's interesting. And especially that part that you identify 100 field leaders that you know that you have to focus on and make sure you have a close communication loop with them. I wanted to ask you, how do you promote your people and what are some of the criteria that you use when promoting? But I expect they are close to the ideas that you presented when interviewing people, like how they help each other and how they perform. But maybe you can tell me, what is the criteria when promoting?
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about the Field Leadership Council I mentioned. You know, if you think of enterprise software companies, 65% of the costs, roughly, are people costs, meaning that's where most of the cost structure of our business is. And this is where the value generation actually comes from. The technology that we have is vitally important. Without the technology, you know, our customers couldn't change or add value to their businesses. But if the technology by itself isn't good enough, because somebody has to understand how to enable that technology to solve a business problem. So people become a really, really important part of our business. So, you know, about right when we started, the second thing we did, talked about the first thing we did was created these operating principles. And shortly thereafter, we created this idea of a Field Leadership Council, because I kind of growing up in an enterprise software world, kind of always appreciated my ability to make an impact as a field leader to the overall company. I wanted to kind of structurally build that into our management process. So we have identified, you know, right now it's grown from about 40 to close to 100, because we've gotten a lot bigger, of field leaders that we put on a council. And that Field Leadership Council is self-managed. Their charter is to understand what's happening across the business, communicate what needs to be done and changed to the executive team, to get all the information about the business in a much more detailed way than the broader organization, so they can disseminate where we are. And that's been really a powerful part of our change process, is leveraging that. But to answer your question about how do we promote people, I really strive to have an organization where we have conversations with our key, you know, rising stars and people that we think are really, you know, valuable to us and have a great potential, is to try to understand where they're trying to take their career, and not just the next part of their career, but like two or three steps, so we can enable a path for them to accomplish their objectives within E2Open. So it would be, what do you want to become as a person that's in charge of, you know, in the product development area? Some people want to run the entire organization. They want to ultimately be in a position to be head of product development for a big company, either ours or somebody else's. Some of our great engineers say, I don't want that at all. I just want to solve the world's hardest problems, and I want to solve our hardest problems. I want a team of 10 people, and that would be perfect for me. So we have an idea that we want to enable everybody to feel like they have an impact every day when they come to work. And that come to work is obviously very interesting, because come to work generally might mean go down to their office, wherever that is. But they feel they can make an impact every day. And they also feel they can meet their own personal and career objectives with inside of E2Open. And if we can accomplish those two things, which is today I can make an impact, not just on my group, but on the organization. And I know that I have a future here, and I can go from A to B to C in my own mind's eye in terms of what I want to do. And we'll have people that want to stay with us, and we'll always want to drive value for our clients. And those two things are what we kind of ground our idea of, you know, promotion. So it's not really who can I promote today. It's what's the right career path for this great individual. And I've also kind of been very attuned to this idea of experience accrues to the account of the individual. And we have a responsibility to make sure that we give them the experiences that accrue to their account, meaning we hope they want to stay with us forever, but we have a responsibility to make sure we give them new and exciting experiences and learning opportunities so they can benefit from that. And that's part of the trade. You know, they add value to us and we add value to them. Hmm. We being a company.
I like how this is connected to long-term in everything you do. you said that you're thinking, okay, what are your next steps, three or four next steps ahead for the career, but also you were talking earlier about the business releases from 1 to 40 with some clients. So I see a connection there. Michael, as we go close to the end of our conversation, the last question I had for you is connected to a successful career, right? Some of the people listening might be at the start of the career. Some of them might be at a junction where they think about making a different step, taking a different route. What would be some of the best piece of advice that you received or you could give for a successful career?
Yeah, maybe I have to think about that one for just a half a second. You know, I've always been the kind of person that always wanted to take on a new challenge. And to me, that was part of what drove my, you know, whatever success I have, is that I always wanted to solve a hard problem. And I've always, you know, ran to those problems. That's me and my personality. And I think it goes back to this idea of authenticity, is you have to have a very clear understanding of, you know, what it is that, you know, drives you as an individual. And that's going to be different for every individual. Some people are going to be, you know, highly ambitious and want to accomplish things and want to go do things. And those people should always try to find their way to an organization that embraces that and that allows them to explore and allows them to try new things and allows them to take on tough challenges. Not everybody has that, you know, not everybody has that approach. Not everybody thinks in those terms. There are lots of people that think in terms of, hey, I really want to just make sure I can have a fulfilling career and take care of my family as my primary driver. And, you know, that's okay. That's equally as valuable as someone that wants to be ambitious and kind of take on, you know, big challenges. There's not one right answer. Not one is not better than the other. And I think people have to have a successful career. I think people have to be a very clear understanding of what their overall objectives are and take on responsibilities and experiences that help them accomplish that objective. Meaning, if I want to be an important person in my area, but I really care about having a very good life quality balance and taking care of my children and my parents because I have to do that right now, then that's great and that's fine. You should think about solving that problem and in a way that makes the most sense and sustainable and, you know, satisfying and in a way that gives them, you know, provides value for them. On the other hand, if you're somebody that says, hey, I really think I want to do something and I want to move up and I want to take on new challenges, you know, then you have to think about the world in that way. So I think it starts with an understanding of what it is your ultimate desire is in terms of your, you know, professional and personal life. And those two things are increasingly intermixed. The number of jobs and careers people have are especially now, are a lot more than they used to be. And I think people have to wake up every day and saying, is this experience I'm having right now helping me accomplish my objectives as a long-term plan? And I think if you take it from that perspective, everything else will flow. So I think it starts with a clear understanding of your own self, your own personality, what your own drivers of success are, your own definition of success, and not being tied into the world's definition of success has to be my definition of success. And I think if people thought about that, they'd be more fulfilled overall. So that's helpful. That's kind of how I think about, you know, careers and success. And I don't think there's one right answer for people.
That's great sharing, Michael. And on that note, I really appreciate your perspectives and sharing about what's happening within the company, outside the company, clients, your perspective on culture, principles. And I thank you for the time, Michael.
Andre, it's great to spend time with you today. I really thank you for the opportunity and hope everybody is well and safe. And this too shall pass. A year from now, we'll look back and we'll say, okay, that was interesting times and we learned a lot from it and we're better for it. And that's kind of my hope, is that we come on the backside of this, really having a deeper understanding of, you know, how we can have a safer, more fulfilling, more peaceful future for everybody and learn from, you know, the times we spent from this past year. So thank you. Thank you. And thank you to your audience.
My pleasure. And I wish you to open even bigger successes and growth. And I'm sure next time we'll talk about the 10x growth or even more than that. So all the best.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Andre.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you like what you heard, be sure to go to www.elcottglobal.com and click the podcast button for all the show notes of the interview. Also, subscribe to our mailing list to get our latest updates first. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes, Spotify or Stitcher, we would appreciate a kind review. 5-star works best to keep us going and our production team happy. And of course, share it with your friends. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me. And if you have any suggestions on what to do and who to invite next, don't hesitate to drop me a note. And if you're looking to hire top executives in supply chain or transform your business, of course, contact us as well to find out how we can help.